So that's the end of the third stanza now of this poem. Now, beginning in chapter 10 with verse 1, we have the last and fourth stanza. Woe unto them that decree unrighteous decrees, and that write grievousness which they have prescribed. Now, them that decree unrighteous decrees are those that pass laws that are unrighteous laws. They rule in a manner that's contrary to what God would have them to do. And they that write grievous, which they have prescribed, would be those who could be in maybe the position of writing the interpretation of the laws, or the result of the trials, or the pleas of the poor people, and things that would go against them so far as justice would be concerned. So he says, to turn aside the needy from judgment, and to take away the right from the poor of my people, that widows may be their prey, and that they may rob the fatherless. That would be the results of these things happening in verse 1. And what will you do in the day of visitation, and in the desolation which shall come from far? To whom will you flee for help, and where will you leave your glory? Now, he's asking them the question, what are you going to do in the day of visitation? We think of visitation as being maybe the end of time when the Lord comes again, but the Lord can have several judgments come upon us, or providences come upon us that are short of the total ultimate end. And so this day of visitation would be no doubt the day whenever Samaria did fall. What are you going to do when Samaria does fall? And in the desolation which shall come from far, to whom will you flee for help, and where will you leave your glory? Now what happened is, Shalmaneser, when he came in to take Samaria, the siege on the city lasted, as I understand it, some 3 years before it finally did fall. And so that would be this day of visitation, and in the desolation which shall come from afar. Without me, they shall bow down under the prisoners, and they shall fall under the slain. What this means is that these people are going to be so weak, so helpless, so unable to protect themselves without God, that they would bow down under others who were already prisoners. They'd be taken captive by the captives, and they shall fall under the slain. They're going to fall under men that are as good as dead, that are really no effective army at all, so far as having to have an army to defeat them. For all this, his anger is not turned away, but his hand is stretched out still. So he still begs and pleads with Israel. The hand is stretched out. I still have my anger, but we can take care of that anger if you will just turn to me. Now that ends the fourth verse then of this poem that began back in the eighth verse of chapter 10, chapter 9. Now beginning in verse 5 of chapter 10, we have another turn. Here we have a prophecy about the Assyrians. And this goes on through the end of this chapter. And really it's carried on, part of this prophecy is carried on even into the 12th chapter. But this is about the Assyrians. Now let's look just for a moment. We named a while ago those four kings of the Assyrians: Tigath-Pileser, Shalmaneser, Sargon, and Sennacherib. And Assyria was used by God for a certain purpose. That purpose was, of course, to overthrow Israel completely and to have them carried away into captivity. But he also is going to use Assyria against Judah. Now, he doesn't intend for Judah to be overthrown completely by Assyria. He will not allow that to happen. But Assyria is going to be his weapon against Judah for a time now. And that'll be this Sennacherib, S-E-N-N-A-C-H-E-R-I-B. So it's very interesting as to what happened with and about this king as he invaded Judah. So in verse 5 he says, O Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, and the staff in their hand is mine indignation. Now, in this verses 5 through 7, he's simply showing that Assyria was used for God's purpose. This is another very strong and emphatic teaching to us that God manipulates governments to do his will as he pleases. And so Assyria was just a tool in God's hands. And he describes it here. He says, Assyria, the rod of mine anger. Assyria, you're a rod. The rod of mine anger. As though I were going to strike Judah with a rod. You're that rod. You're the rod of mine anger. And the staff in their hand is mine indignation. I will send him against an hypocritical nation. And against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey and to tread them down like mire of the streets. Now this is what he's telling that Assyria is going to do. You're going up against a hypocritical nation, against the people of my wrath. Howbeit, he meaneth not so, neither doth he, doth his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and cut off nations, not a few. Now Assyria doesn't know that it's working in God's hands as one of God's tools. Assyria doesn't know that it's just carrying out God's purpose against Judah. Assyria is thinking quite differently. In Assyria's heart, Assyria thinks, I'm going to destroy many nations. And this is just one of many that I'm going to destroy. For he saith, are not my princes altogether kings? This is what Assyria is saying now. All of my princes, they're kings. And the revised, the American translation says, all of my captains are kings. In other words, this country had taken so many nations over, and we're talking about Israel, and we're talking about the Philistines and the little nations round about, and on down into Egypt. They'd already conquered them, and now here they're coming back up as they come up from Egypt as though they have a big rod in their hand, and they're going to smite Judah as they come by. And they've taken so many and had to place so many of the captains over these nations to rule them and to carry out governmental authority that he said, all of my captains are kings. And so Israel, Judah, was just going to be one little nation in a long line of other nations, not realizing that God was just going to let them do a certain amount to Judah and then they'd be driven back. They didn't know that they were just working God's purpose. And so verse 9, he says, is not Calno and Charchimish as Charchimish? Is not Hamath as Arpad? Is not Samaria as Damascus? And this is a real difficult verse for me to interpret. The books that I have really say nothing about what this verse means. But to me, it means that all of these cities that they'd already conquered, he's saying it isn't one city just like the other now. They're all under Assyrian dominion. They're all being ruled by my captains. And so one doesn't really make much difference over the other. One just like the other. And so is Judah going to be any different? Can we expect anything different from Judah? As my hand hath found the kingdoms of the idols, and whose graven images did excel them of Jerusalem and of Samaria, shall I not, as I have done unto Samaria and her idols, so do to Jerusalem and her idols? I think what he's saying here, this is still Assyria talking. It's a little hard to know if it's Assyria or God talking, but I think it's still Assyria talking. And Assyria is saying that my hand has found the kingdoms of the idols whose graven images did excel them of Jerusalem and Samaria. I've been in kingdoms that have idols that are much greater than anything you got down in Jerusalem and Samaria. Well, you have idols, all right. You've turned to idols, but you're just pikers compared to what these other nations are. They have idols that you wouldn't believe, and I conquered them. Their gods didn't help them, and here you're trying to pattern after them. You got idols too, but won't I be able to take you like I did them? Because their idols didn't help them any. Shall I not, verse 11, as I have done unto Samaria and her idols, so do to Jerusalem and her idols? And is not this a way that God would have to chide this city for having idols? Oh, Jerusalem, are you really going to depend upon your idols now? like Samaria did and like the other cities did, those idols which didn't do them any good, those idols which are much greater than yours, they have a lot more workmanship and more artistic ability. They're greater idols than you'll ever have, but they didn't help them. Jerusalem, are you going to turn to them or not? Who's your God going to be? But this was the reasoning that Assyria had. You know, different from the rest. I took them, I'll take you. And of course, you know, today if we have idols, like the people around about us, then the ungodly persons have no other way to think other than we're all alike. I think this, you know, in relation to such things as the Christmas tree. You have a Christmas tree like everybody else. You must be putting some kind of stock in it. It must be some kind of religious image to you, or you wouldn't have one like all the other people. And it's going to serve you just like it did them. They're going to be your God? If I'd been in Jerusalem and had anything look like an idol after reading this, I'd want to get rid of it. I'd be grinding that thing into powder and throwing it to the wind or something. Because you can see very plainly that you're going to be just like the other nations if you depend on these idols. Now, beginning in verse 12, God is really saying here that Assyria is going to be punished for boasting. Now, Assyria had done quite a bit of boasting in verses 8, 9, and 10, and 11. All my captains are kings. All these cities are the same. And I've taken these nations that have greater idols than you have. So in verse 12, wherefore it shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. Now let's look at this verse 12. It shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and Jerusalem. He's just using Assyria to do a job here for him. Assyria's just going to do a little job of work for him. And whenever he's done this work, when I finish the work that he's going to do on Jerusalem and on Mount Zion, he really didn't take Jerusalem and Mount Zion. He just got down to the brink of them. And when he's finished that work, then he says, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria. Ah, this king of Assyria who thinks he's so great, who thinks he has something to boast and brag about because I'm just using him as an instrument here, and he doesn't even know it. I'm going to punish his stout heart also, and the glory of his high looks. For he saith, by the strength of mine hand I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I am prudent, and I have removed the bounds of the people, and have robbed their treasures, and I have put down the inhabitants like a valiant man. And my hand hath found as a nest the riches of the people, and as one gathereth eggs that are left, have I gathered all the earth, and there was none that moved the wing, or opened the mouth, or peeped. This is the way Assyria bragged. This is the way old Sennacherib was bragging about his accomplishments. Well, he said, I'm wise and I'm prudent and I've done it by the strength of my own hand. I removed the bounds of these people. Well, I have one nation that looks just like any other nation. There's no boundary between them. They all belong to me. And I've robbed their treasures. I put down the inhabitants like a valiant man. And my hand hath found as a nest the riches of the people. He said, my conquering of these people is just like somebody who's found a nest. A nest is full of eggs. And so I just gather all the eggs out of the nest. That's what I've done. It says, one gathereth eggs that are left. I've gathered all the earth. Oh, what boasting, what bragging, what bravado he seems to have here. And there was none that moved the wing. Now, have you ever gone and gathered eggs out of an old hen's nest or other birds too, pigeons I know, and as you reach your hand up in there, they take that wing and slap you with it? It doesn't hurt you too bad, but it sure does scare you if you're not used to what's going to happen. Or some old hens will take their beak and they'll peck you. Or some give out a squawk. But he says, when I rob this nest of the riches of the people as one that gathers the eggs that are left, that's the way I gathered all the earth, there was none that moved the wing or opened the mouth or peeped. They didn't even fight back like a chicken would. Now today, in our stereotypes of thinking of a chicken as being a coward, this might even have a deeper meaning. I don't know if those people of that day had the same feeling that we do or not. When we call somebody a chicken, we're calling them a coward. He said, you didn't even fight like a chicken. So he further tells now, beginning in verse 15, of this destruction that's going to come upon Assyria. Shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith? Now, does the axe have any right to boast what all it's done and not give the man who's swinging the axe any credit for it at all? That's the way Assyria was. It was just like an axe in the hands of a man as God used it to carry out his purpose. Or shall the saw magnify itself against him that shaketh it? Same deal with the saw. As if the rod should shake itself against them that lift it up, or as if the staff would lift up itself as if it were no wood. It's just like the staff is starting trying to act like it's a living being, and that it has the power to move itself and to think and to direct its own actions. Staff doesn't have that kind of power. It's just a piece of wood. And so when it starts to bragging against the man that handles it, it's acting like it's not wood anymore. And that's what Assyria is doing. Assyria is acting like it's not just an instrument, just a tool in the hands of God. Therefore shall the Lord of hosts, send among his fat ones leanness, and under his glory he shall kindle a burning like the burning of a fire. Now when it came right down to it, and we're going to cover this passage when we finish this chapter, or about the time we finish this chapter, over in 2 Kings 18 and 19, particularly the 19th chapter, when it came right down to it, whenever Assyria had gone as far as God would let them go, they got right up to the very brink of Jerusalem. Some of these towns named over here in verses 28 and 29 are 3 and 4 miles from Jerusalem. He says that he conquered 46 walled cities in Judah. And I don't know how many hundreds or thousands of people they took into captivity. But when God decided he'd used Assyria enough, in one blow, 185,000 Assyrians were killed. God just began to wipe his army out miraculously as he dealt with Hezekiah and with this Assyrian king. So he says, therefore shall the Lord of hosts, send among his fat ones leanness, and under his glory he shall kindle a burning like the burning of a fire. The most glorious people that he has are going to be burned like the burning of a fire. And the light of Israel shall be for a fire, and his Holy One for a flame, and it shall burn and devour his thorns and his briars in one day, and shall consume the glory of his forest, and of his fruitful field, both soul and body, and they shall be as when a standard bearer fainteth. So he's going to take care of Assyria when the time comes, because of his boasting. He's going to burn and devour his thorns and briars in one day. Now that'd be the lowest people in his army. And he's going to consume the glory of his forest, the fruitful field. That is the highest tree that he has. He'll consume it also, both soul and body. And they shall be as when a standard bearer fainteth. Here's a standard bearer carrying high the standard, the flag, and he faints. What happens when he faints? The flag falls with him. And the rest of the trees of his forest shall be few, that a child may write them. In other words, there's going to be such a small number left in his forest, the trees of his forest, which would be the mighty men of his army, that they're going to be so few that a child could count them. Now, beginning in verse 20, God again promises that he will intervene for his people whenever this Assyrian onslaught occurs. And it shall come to pass in that day that the remnant of Israel, and such as are escaped of the house of Jacob, shall no more again stay upon him that smote them, but shall stay upon the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. So he says, in that day, Israel is not going to lean upon Assyria, the one that smote them. And we can read over there in 2 Kings 18, where he took the gold off of the temple and the door off of it and gave to this king, trying to appease him, trying to use this as a way to gain an alliance with him. He says the time's coming when they're not going to lean or have a stay upon the one that will smite them, but they'll lean upon the Lord, the Holy One of Israel, in truth. The remnant shall return, even the remnant of Jacob, unto the mighty God. Now God is going to destroy many of these people, but he predicts there's going to be a remnant that will return. And truly there was a remnant that did return to God. And this kingdom lasted for about another 100 years before it really was taken away. And that was just a type of a greater remnant yet that would come back from the captivity. And that was a type of a greater remnant yet that would be in the church. And he's always talking about a remnant. I'm going to punish you. I'm going to kill many people or destroy many people, but there'll be a remnant left. And that remnant will serve me. And that's what he's saying here. For though thy people Israel be as the sand of the sea, yet a remnant of them shall return. The consumption decreed shall overflow with righteousness. Now the consumption is the destruction here that God brings upon them. And it's going to, although it's a destruction, it's going to overflow with righteousness. For the Lord God of hosts shall make a consumption even determined in the midst of the land. Now what that really means is that the Lord God of hosts shall make a destruction, even a decisive and complete destruction in the midst of all the land. That's this Assyrian attack that they're going to have. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God of hosts, O my people that dwellest in Zion, be not afraid of the Assyrian. He shall smite thee with a rod, and shall lift up his staff against thee after the manner of Egypt. Now this is thought by some to mean that as he comes back from his conquering of Egypt, just as he went down and smote Egypt, he's going to come up, and as he rides by, he's going to smite you, like he did Egypt. But it's also thought to mean that he is going to smite you like you were smitten by the Egyptians. For yet a very little while, and the indignation shall cease, and mine anger in their destruction. Now, it's just a little while, he says, and this indignation is going to cease. This attack by Assyria upon you is going to come to an end. And the Lord of hosts shall stir up a scourge for him according to the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Oreb. And as his rod was upon the sea, so shall he lift it up after the manner of Egypt. Now, we studied last time about the destruction of the Midianites. Whenever they were destroyed and part of them fled to this place known as the Rock of Oreb, and there they were captured and destroyed. And so he's comparing the destruction of Assyria as whenever the Midianites were destroyed. And he also compares it to his rod was upon the sea, that is, whenever they went through the Red Sea and the Egyptians were pursuing them, and he raised his rod, so to speak, and the sea drowned the Egyptians and saved the Israelites. And it shall come to pass in that day that his burden shall be taken away from off thy shoulder, and his yoke from off thy neck, and the yoke shall be destroyed because of the anointing. So there's that day then, the attacked by Assyria would be taken off of these people. Like I say, they destroyed at least 46 walled cities of Judea, and got within 3 or 4 miles of the city itself. And so in verses 28 and 29 and 30, he names some of these little towns, and you can find them on the map. He has come to Aiath. He has passed to Migron. As at Mishmash, he hath laid up his carriages. They are gone over the passage. They've taken up their lodging at Geba. Ramah is afraid. Gibeah of Saul is fled. Lift up thy voice, O daughter of Gallim. Cause it to be heard unto Lash, O poor Anathoth. Madmenah is removed. The inhabitants of Gibeah gather themselves together to flee. As yet shall he remain at Nob that day. He shall shake his hand against the mount of the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem. Now, as we said, these little towns were located north of Jerusalem, some of them very close, and it's thought that Nob, here in verse 32, is the last town that he was at before God did destroy him, and Nob is in the very near vicinity of Mount Zion, right there at the very edge of Jerusalem itself. He didn't actually take Zion. He didn't actually take Jerusalem. But when he got to that point, then he shall shake his hand against the mount of the daughter of Zion, the hill of Jerusalem. Now in the last two verses he tells of the actual fall of Assyria. So we'll just go ahead and read these two verses. Behold, the Lord of hosts, shall lop the bow with terror, and the high ones of stature shall be hewn down and the mighty shall be humbled. It's as though this was a forest, or this was a huge tree, and the Lord's just going to cut it down. He's going to lop the bough with terror. And the high ones of stature shall be hewn down, and the mighty shall be humbled. And he shall cut down the thickets of the forest with iron, and Lebanon shall fall by a mighty one. This is showing the fall of Assyria. He cuts down this forest. He hews it right down to the ground so that there's not any forest left. Nothing left but the roots. Well, our time is just about expired here. And next time we do want to go and read some of those things said in 2 Kings 19 about this Assyrian attack and the dealings with Hezekiah. We would tonight, but we won't be able to get through it before our complete hour is expired. Anybody have any questions or comments on the material covered tonight?
Back when we're in the 10th verse, where they're talking about building back bigger stones, were they talking about building pyramids?
No. This is up in Israel. This is not down in Egypt. And I don't know if they ever built any pyramids in Israel or not. I really doubt they did. What they're really talking about there is replacing their buildings that were made of brick that had been destroyed, replacing them with the better rocks of the hewn stones. I really couldn't take that to mean pyramids at all.
That's Christ's prophecy about Christ. This is not the first time the Old Testament Christ has been prophesied.
Oh, no. No. Christ prophesied right over in Genesis. It's not the first time in Isaiah he's been prophesied either. We've had him several times in the book of Isaiah prophesied. In the second chapter and in the fourth chapter, he was also prophesied. And again in the seventh chapter, talked about his virgin birth. Now here in the ninth chapter, he's prophesied. Yeah, just all through Isaiah, he's prophesied.
I didn't remember there were so many
in Isaiah. Yeah. This is at least the fourth prophecy about Christ in Isaiah. And here we are. That's in the ninth chapter.
Don't both books of the prophets mention something about it?
Yeah, as far as I know, they do. Yeah.
Amos.
Now, we're really going to get into some quite interesting material in this 11th chapter. Some things that are a little difficult to explain, but they are things about the kingdom. And that are certainly misinterpreted. Some of the groups like the Jehovah's Witnesses, they take this and build a whole doctrine on it that's all out of proportion to what the rest of the Bible teaches. So you might go ahead and read this 11th chapter and get some idea here as to what he's saying before we get into an explanation of it. And I hope that what we said about chapter 10 made it plain enough to understand what that is saying. I spent close to 6 hours of study on this material we covered tonight. But that's all. We'll just conclude at that point then, and Lord willing, beginning at that point next time.